You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. Growing up in Brooklyn, Paul Pines was always labeled the bad boy in his family, while his younger brother Claude gave his parents nothing to worry about. Their roles reversed years later when Claude became haunted by paranoid delusions and ultimately was diagnosed with schizophrenia. Paul Pines shares his family story and Claude's struggle with mental illness in his memoir, My Brother's Madness. It's published by Curbstone Press, and I'd like to welcome Paul Pines to the Leonard Lopate Show. Hello.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming by. Your brother died last year of a childhood heart condition that you believe was made worse by the stresses of his illness and his life. Is that what prompted this memoir?
No, the memoir was 6 years in the making. My brother died. He survived the valve, which is often attached to the condition of schizophrenia. There's a
really?
Connection there. Yeah. You find a frequency of this kind of...
It was a mitral valve.
It's a mitral
prolapse.
Valve. That's prolapse. And he was diagnosed by my father, who was a doctor, early in his life with that. There's a high incidence of that in schizophrenics, too. So there's a body-mind connection there, which is very interesting. But he didn't actually die of that. He died of leukemia. He was diagnosed with leukemia after I thought I had finished the memoir. And I'd given him the memoir to read. I'd asked his permission to write this memoir. And he'd thought about it for a minute. And at first he wasn't sure. But then he gave me his permission to do it. He said his thinking was that this would somehow redeem the suffering that he had been through. It would make it useful to others. And even though he might not emerge as he would have liked, he thought he would take the chance on letting me write it.
How did you go about presenting this to your brother? How do you pitch that?
Well, you pitch it directly.
Hey, Claude, I want to write a story about your madness.
I want to write a story about our lives, because really it's a story, it's a family saga. And it's, you know, no less, I mean, one could talk about it as a book about mental illness and its stress on the family, but then one could talk about Oedipus Rex that way. One could talk about Hamlet that way. One could say, poor Hamlet, he was bipolar. we could talk about it in those terms, but I'd rather, first of all, talk about it in terms of really kind of a classic story about people living out their fates under extreme circumstances. Because from the point of view that I was writing now in my 60s, the pattern, the destiny, you know, is kind of already in place there. There's no guessing about the way the pattern. It's a matter of reading the pattern. So the memoir was an attempt to write about the pattern.
Right. Your book grapples with this nature or nurture debate about what caused your brother's madness.
Right.
Is there a history of schizophrenia in your family?
Well, you know, maybe undiagnosed. My mother had, and she's a character in this. I mean, my family...
I was going to ask about your mom. She had some pretty bizarre moments.
My family is full of characters. And again, if we were in ancient Greece, this would be the stuff of myth. My mother had, certainly clearly paranoid tendencies, but she remained highly functional in her own way. And my father, I think, was depressed. And one can see the generational transmission of certain qualities in most families. You know, as a psychotherapist, if someone comes in to me and says they have a extreme depression, I mean, I know the odds are someone in their either immediate family or their non-immediate family has suffered from the same thing. So there are generational transmissions. Whether those transmissions are genetic or environmental remains somewhat vague. I would posit that there's a dynamic relationship between the two.
Your family environment was stressful and often abusive.
Right.
Did you and Claude have different ways of dealing with this?
Well, our childhood was rather gothic. My brother was 2 years younger than myself, and those 2 years made a great deal of difference.
I want to go back. Gothic in what way?
Well, it was gothic in that there was a lot of what Jungians would call shadow material, these demons stepping out of the shadows. My father married twice. His relationship with my mother was very, very stormy. She left the house, left us with our father, who was otherwise very busy, didn't have much time for us, but had very high standards for us, had high expectations. He married a second wife who I would say, if not sociopathic, certainly tended in that direction. And that was at a time when I could leave the house. I could go out into the world, but my brother was stuck in that environment. Mm. And so the reality he lived with a very sadistic but apparently sweet woman who divided him from his father and, in fact, became rather threatening and lethal, became the seeds of his later florid delusions. And the life he lived as a teen, if he went out and told people that, they would have looked at him and have asked, well, you must be paranoid. You couldn't possibly be describing the woman we see. Later, of course, this played into the nature of his delusion. And in the book, I try to work with the delusional material as it evolved from his early experience to show the connection between the early experience. My own response was I was older, and I think those 2 years made a great deal of difference in terms of ego strength and ego formation. I had a view of my circumstances which allowed me to step outside of it a little bit from a very early age and observe it and be aware at some level that the world was bigger than what I was experiencing. And I think that perception was very crucial to allowing me to survive. And so I couldn't wait to get out into the world. And the very breaking apart of the family allowed me to do that early.
I'm speaking with Paul Pines. He's the author of My Brother's Madness, a memoir. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. When did you first become aware that there might be something seriously wrong with Claude?
Well, it evolved slowly. Certainly, Claude, as a college student, found it difficult to settle in anywhere. He was very shy. He found it difficult to make friends. He went through medical school in Brussels. He took the first 3 years of his medical training in French, and then he transferred back to Einstein to do his last year there. And the pressure of the atmosphere at Einstein, the competitive pressure, really was too much for him, and he cracked. And he left Einstein about 6 months before getting his MD. And at that time, I was running my jazz club on the Bowery. And I became aware at that point that there were serious problems with Claude, and I urged him to seek help, and he was very resistant to seeking help. He reinvented himself by going back to Columbia and becoming a microbiologist and functioned in the laboratories of various hospitals until, as I open my book with this scene, at my wedding, he appears at my wedding in upstate New York, and his eyes are dilated, and he is talking about what was patently a paranoid delusional system.
And what finally led him to seek treatment, if he was so capable and functioning at such a high level?
My brother functioned at a high level, except the circumstances of his paranoia made it impossible for him to continue in these laboratories, because he imagined everyone in these laboratories was somehow watching him with an eye toward indicting him of some crime which he could not define. And this became increasingly florid. The delusions do not stay in a steady state. They grow. And he could not figure out, he could not say who was mounting the persecution. And, of course, the answer to that, eventually he found out, it was himself. And why and what crime he had committed. So as his paranoia grew more extreme, more and more extreme, there reached a point when he said to me, my pursuers have made it into my dreams. I have nowhere to hide.
Oh, how painful that must have been.
And I said, yes, there is something we can do. So I kind of talked him into a voluntary commitment. I kind of tricked him into it. I said, I know a place you can go for refuge where you might even find out who it is and why you're in this situation. So he voluntarily agreed to come into what was New York Hospital, Bloomingdale's, and was there for a year, and it was a very rocky ride there.
Now, leading up to this moment, which you start the book with, your wedding in 1986.
Yes.
You had been living a wild child life.
Very much so.
Drugs, alcohol. You introduced your brother to cocaine.
Right.
He later
All
became
of that.
Addicted to cocaine.
Yeah.
Do you have any guilt feelings about that?
Well, no, not really. I when I read that part and think about that part, my heart stops a little bit. But I see it again from another perspective now. I mean, we were both trying our best to get by. We were both trying. And when my addiction to cocaine was really, like most addicts, was a kind of self-medicating.
Mm. So this is your way of dealing with it, also his way of dealing
with
it.
Well, I was medicating against the depression, and I thought, here I will show my brother how to deal with his depression. So at that time, we sat there, and our first experience together was in his little underground apartment on 75th Street, and I describe this in the book. And we sit there, and for a moment, we really leave the depression behind and begin to talk to each other.
And you move on to... Mm-hmm. Have a successful career as a writer, and this jazz club enterprise succeeded for you. Did you feel guilt over your escape of his fate? Is all of this in this memoir really trying to work that out?
You know, I've been presenting this book around, and that seems to be the prevailing question.
Well, it's also a question that he presented to you. He rails against you, saying, "You're at fault."
I'm the fault, and that was his.
It should have been right.
That was his position. I played by the rules, and you didn't.
Right.
Look at what happened to me, and look at what's happened to you. And of course, my understanding of that is not literal. You know, I played by the rules that allowed me to survive. I admitted my own anger. I acted out my own anger. And I felt like the damned. I felt like the bad boy. But again, looking back from this perspective, it was the way I kept myself intact. And, you know, my father's curse for me was, "You're going to wind up on the Bowery," he would say. And his scenario was that my brother would drive up in his Cadillac and pick me out of the doorway with the other winos and save my life. Well, I did wind up on the Bowery, except I had a jazz club there. And, you know, every step of the way felt as fraught with danger to me as my brother's life did to him. You know, I improvised my life. My brother really didn't. My brother tried to move through the accepted choreography. And, you know, I'm a jazz guy by temperament. I love the improvised solo. And I have always come from the improvisational perspective with a certain kind of faith that the forces that moved me were forces to be honored, forces to be reckoned with.
Given the recent incident of the police shooting a unarmed young man, Kyle Coppin, in Brooklyn on Monday night, who appears now to have been suffering from mental illness,
Right. Do
we need to have better training of police officers when it comes to recognizing mental illness?
Well, I think we need to have better social awareness of what mental illness is. I think we're terrified of the psyche. I think as a culture, we're terrified of our own unconsciouses. You know, we are a culture that suffers from disconnection and desensitization. And by and large, most of the people I work with, no matter what their diagnosis is, it involves reconnecting people who have disconnected deeply because of trauma. And they only come to see me because the pain of the disconnection becomes worse than the actual event from which they're disconnecting, or their ability to function becomes so impaired that they have to do that. So I think that the police is one expression of our social disconnection is evident. It's a kind of screaming red flag that we do not know how to relate to our own shadows, our own darkness, our own pain. And we take out the gun and we shoot it.
You had many careers before you became a psychotherapist. What finally made you turn to the mental health field?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in the psyche. I'm interested in the mind. And when I said to you that there was always a part of me that observed, Winnicott would call that the observing ego, that there was a part of me that was always interested in why people did what they did. I looked around me and I saw this behavior and I didn't quite understand it. So the idea of finding out, you know, what was what moved people, the great mystery, and what was the meaning of what they did has always been with me. And as a writer, I was a poet when I first took out a piece of paper and looked at the blank sheet and said, well, I can say anything here. And I discovered things about myself that I didn't know already. And I became aware that there was a latent intelligence in my own mind which could reveal myself to me. And as a writer and a teacher of creative writing, that was my message to my students, that there is a latent intelligence, if you will, reconnect, because we tend to disconnect. Where society, I said to my creative writing students, by the time you hit 18 with all the social messages, you have disconnected from your own imagery. So what I do now with one-to-one is really what I've done with myself, with my students, all along.
You have a poem in your book. I just wanted to conclude with you reading that.
Sure. This is a poem that was set by a composer, Dan Asia, who's been setting my poems for a number of years. And the poem in the book comes from the occasion that I'm going to the 92nd Street Y to hear his concert version of this. And the poem is called Mein Bruder. I want to write a poem to you, Claude, who never believed my words but endured me as a brother who couldn't see you. In spite of which, we managed to agree. It is a pity anyone should suffer for being what one is. Then tell me why it's true that halfway through my life, I rush around afraid the world will stop if I do. Then stop and realize you are among my deepest sorrows.
Does he remain one of your deepest sorrows, or did writing the book help?
Oh, he remains one of the richest sources of my own development.
I've been speaking with Paul Pines. He's the author of My Brother's Madness, a memoir published by Curbstone Press. Thank you so much for joining us on the Leonard Lopate Show today.
Thank you, Amy.